Well, this is Jerry Pippin, and we are here in Eureka Springs, Arkansas, at the Ozark UFO Conference, and this is the 20th year, Ted Phillips.
Yes.
I met you here several years ago for the first time.
Indeed, yes.
And we had a great show, mm-hmm. and you talked about this thing you found in a cave over in Yugoslavia or someplace?
Slovakia.
Okay, that was close.
Yeah. in the neighborhood.
why don't you tell us a little bit about that right off the bat for people who we do still have that interview available if people would like to find it. We had your picture there on a gallery of guests, and click on Ted Phillips' picture and you can hear it. But give us a recap here of what's happening.
Yeah, the what we're calling it currently is Project Moonshaft, and
why did you guys name it that?
Well, the gentleman that found it, a Czech engineer, Antonin Hurok, was hidden in the cave from the Germans in October of 1944 during the war, and when he finally reached this thing a couple of miles deep in the cavern, it was a sort of vertical shaft, and the overall shape of this structure is sort of a fat crescent moon. And so he named it the Moon Shaft, and so we've kind of carried that along. And
now, have we figured out what that stuff's made of?
No, we don't know. I've been to Slovakia on two occasions, yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And each time by myself, and it's you can't get quite enough done under those circumstances. But I did find what I believe is the cave, and there are a lot of indicators in the first couple of thousand feet of the cave. And I have the original 1944 sketch of the cavern in great detail from Hurok, and at least the first 2,000 feet it matches the sketch. And unfortunately, in the early 1945, the Russians did a lot of aerial bombing in that area, and craters are still visible, and it has shaken the cave a couple of thousand feet in, and it was pretty risky for a single individual to try to get through the area. It's possible. I mean, I could have done it, but not very wise.
Now when we talk about this this object, does it put off some sort of vibration or tone or something?
Well, I could detect from the surface with a electromagnetic field meter and also compasses by placing them in this one area. Each time I would pass through it on the surface, batteries on the equipment would start dying off and just were dead. And so the third trip through, I took the EM meter and three compasses, and I placed them on the ground in this area, set up the camcorder on a tripod, backed it out of the area, and zoomed in. And all of these instruments were swinging in two-second sweeps. So what was being picked up was a magnetic emission, and on the tri-field meter, an electromagnetic emission. And the interesting thing was, about a week after I did that, I found the cave entrance, and in exploring the cave, I surveyed it, and it was actually turning back in the direction of this area. And the Russians also have found very old manuscripts where villagers described a large, dark object, a curved object that came out of the sky with a great deal of noise and landed on the ground, and the villagers could see it from miles away. It was that tall, but gradually it was getting shorter, and finally it disappeared over a period of about 4 weeks, and the villagers went into the area and they found not the object but a large opening in the ground where evidently this thing had somehow pushed itself deep in underground.
So either it was really heavy or it forced its way down there or something.
Yeah. And it was, you know, it was making ear-splitting sounds, whatever that might indicate. But the really interesting thing is the Russians, this particular Russian scientist I'm in contact with, in going into that area, found an electromagnetic emission pulsing on 2 seconds coming out of this hole. So perhaps there are two.
And you think it's still pulsing?
Yes. Oh, yes. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And this is one reason you think you found the location of the right cave.
Yes, exactly.
And your last trip, you made it a couple thousand feet down?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
What are we talking about here? Is it like a spelunker trip through Merrimack Cave or something? or are we talking about a little hole in the ground? Or what are we talking about?
Oh, no. It's quite a large cavern. The entrance is very small and low. But the cavern immediately opens up. And it's a very complex cave system, at least the first 2,000 feet. And
by complex, you mean it has lots of entrances or
lots of side passages, other channels that you could travel.
And this fellow who was hiding from the Nazis.
Yes.
How did you find out about him? Was it a diary or something?
Well, I had a friend in 1970 give me a call, and he said, "I have a neighbor you need to talk to." And he knew of my interest, number one, in caves and also in physical evidence relating to UFOs, and so he briefly went through the story, and in less than 2 weeks I was out there, and my wife and I spent 2 days with Hurok and his wife Anna and at their home, and we viewed the 1944 original diary that he had maintained through the war. And while he was in the cavern and inside the structure, he sketched the object. He measured it very carefully. He was an engineer with 4 degrees in engineering, linguistics, and business management. Very intelligent man. And, of course, when the Nazis invaded Czechoslovakia and Poland, they arrested him, put him in a concentration camp, took everything that he and his wife had, and he escaped in 1941 from the concentration camp into Slovakia and joined the Slavic Underground Army. Mm-hmm. And it was during a large firefight with the Nazis that he and two of his men were seriously injured and wounded, and they woke up the next morning with Slavik, a Slovakian sheepman, treating their wounds, building a stretcher, and he took them to this cave and hid them in the High Tatra Mountains. It's a pretty remarkable story.
Yeah, it certainly is, and we talk about that. You're pretty certain that this was an object that fell from the sky because of the stories you've heard or read.
Since then, yes.
The original thing when you told me about mm-hmm. the story several years ago, mm-hmm. I was thinking about maybe it's the Ark of the Covenant.
Well, you know, you do start thinking along those terms the fascinating thing about this artifact structure is that the outer wall, which was, of course, the first thing he saw, 2 miles back in the cave, 2,700 feet below the mountaintop. And the outer wall, the exposed area, was framed with cave formations, flowstone and limestone and stalactites. And they were affixed to the wall, the outside of the wall. Well, one thing we know is how long it takes those types of formations to grow. And we're talking many thousands of years. And there was a crack in this wall. The wall itself, as he went through it, measured 7 feet in thickness. And when he was in the interior of this thing, this moon-shaped structure, it went up to an unknown height. He could see, he could light it about 100 feet above him. And it went on. And below him, the very fascinating thing is there is a incline which he thought was the floor of the inside of this thing. And it was a limestone deposit. And he took his military pickaxe and he chopped through this stuff in one of the horns of the crescent and found that it was 60 inches thick. Well, 60 inches of limestone equals about 6,000 years of deposit inside this thing that has flowstone formations on the outer wall. Beneath the 6,000 years of limestone, he finds the skeleton of a very large animal. And he brought out two of the teeth with him, and after the war, had them identified by one of the leading paleontologists as prehistoric cave bear. So we have underneath 6,000 years of limestone the skeleton of a prehistoric cave bear, which has to be over.
How big would that be?
The cave bear was about 20 feet long and they weighed about 2 tons.
You
very large.
You wouldn't want to run into one.
No, you would not. And but the age of the cave bear would be somewhere beyond 100,000 years. Mm-hmm. So you're beginning to add up the fact that this thing is very, very old. And the cave bear skeleton was lying on what he described as a constructed wavy grill work. And he thought he could feel heat coming up through it from below, put his ear and cheek against the grill, and could feel warm air coming up, which is a rarity in deep caverns, and at some great distance below him. And remember, this is a very trained, highly trained engineer used to the underground. He could hear what sounded like a large turbine running. So
I remember when you related that story, mm-hmm. that's where I got it was making some sort of noise.
Yes, exactly. And so, you know, I have the feeling this is something that should be looked at.
And I understand you're putting another expedition together.
Yes,
maybe.
Right. Yeah, the team, as soon as we get the proper funding to do the
What would an underwriter need to do to get a hold of you? You got a great website now.
Oh, it is. Adam Johnson, our webmaster, has done an incredible job with this. And, just go to ufophysical.com. And click on Project Moonshaft, and you can read the original diary. Sketches from the diary are there, along with a lot of other very current and interesting information. So, yeah, we're very proud of the website. Absolutely.
I don't know. I don't know how one goes about getting funding for these sort of things, but I guess. Maybe somebody listening, you never know. They might be interested.
Exactly. And, of course, we do.
Do you work with a university or anything like that?
We've not had any real luck.
Yeah.
The problem is, unless you have photographs of such a thing, they're not willing to go out on a limb and invest. But there are private individuals. A friend of mine who was the CEO of a very large web company, funded the second trip over. And, it would not require a tremendous amount of money. Just all we're looking for is enough to get the job done right.
And they can get in touch with you through that website.
Yes, right. Mm-hmm.
I noticed on that website you have something there called Hard Evidence, the Ted Phillips story. I want to find out about what that's all about when we come back. This is Jerry Pippin. We'll be right back.
Marvelous Marv Grand Canyon Tours offers you a unique look at one of the great wonders of the world, the Grand Canyon.
Been at the Grand Canyon area most of my life, so pretty much grew up in the area and know quite a few things that the common tourist doesn't know. And I need to avoid all the people and stuff and try to take them to secluded areas.
A day excursion, personally, conducted by Marvelous Marv.
Yeah, we started about 8 o'clock in the morning. We're done about 4:30. Absolutely. And I have a little photo CD disc for him with 1,000 of my favorite pictures and some video. And
no other tour offers so much, and no other personalized tour offers a better price.
No, I'm still the same, and I'm the most reasonable price tour of the Grand Canyon now. $85 a person. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Call 928-707-0291 or check him out at marvelousmarv.com.
Ted Phillips is our guest, and this is Jerry Pippin, and we're broadcasting from Eureka Springs. And Ted, you've been in a lot of countries in your search for. How would you describe what you're searching for?
Well, primarily, my interest is in UFO research involving the landing of flying saucers, mm-hmm. and in making contact with the ground, leaving behind or generating physical residue. And in other words, not just another story, but something you can put your hands on. And I started this in 1968 at the request of Dr. J. Allen Hynek. And currently we have 3,389 cases involving UFO landings and physical residue.
That many?
From 92 countries, yes.
Wow. Wow.
Yeah. A lot of data, really.
Yeah, that is.
Yes.
And what do you draw from this data?
Well, what I can see, based on the facts as they present themselves, that we're dealing with some sort of constructed devices, machines, by virtue of how they're seen, what they do when they're seen, how they interact with the soil and the immediate surrounding area. One of the great things is that in the cases of the larger objects, they land on either three legs or four. And at the end of those legs, of course, are landing pads of various configurations. And by taking compression tests in those footpad marks...
Can you figure out how heavy it is?
Exactly, yeah. And
how heavy is it?
Well, depending on the type of object, mm-hmm. The range runs from 7 to 12 tons. And so, in other words, all of a sudden, we're not talking about a story. We're talking about a physical mass.
Right.
Something, without question, was there. And contrary to popular belief, UFOs are not all lights in the distance in the night sky. In the landing cases, a high percentage of those reports are made by multiple witnesses in daylight within 50 feet of the landed object. And over a period of time long enough to be sure it's not the Goodyear blimp,
sure.
Or a hot air balloon or whatever, mm-hmm. that it is indeed something very strange and out of the ordinary. And during that period of time, they see the object generating the physical evidence. And so this puts it in an entirely different light. I mean, you're dealing with something close for a long duration, good seeing conditions, multiple witnesses, the best cases we have, I think.
And these things are similar worldwide?
Yes, they are, yeah. The really fascinating thing that I learned over many years, too many years perhaps, of researching
these
things.
You'll never catch me. Go ahead. That's one good thing.
Well, the thing that I began to see was that I could go to a new case and without knowing anything about the landing site, talk to the witnesses, interview the witnesses, and determine the approximate size, configuration, description of the object. And before I even went to the site, I had a really good idea of what I was going to find. They are that repeatable. They're consistent. They're like fingerprints.
What are size of these objects? Are they more or less about the same size? Or?
They're not large. You know, occasionally you hear about the 300-foot-long objects,
right.
And so on. The landing devices tend to be in a range of 4 to 8 feet, 8 feet to 12, 12 to 18 feet. And those three particular
models.
Types, yes.
Yeah.
And then there's a smaller model, which is less than 1 meter in diameter. And those kind of reports are very much on the increase since the late 90s, whereas the 18-foot jobs are on the decrease.
So the smaller ones, and we've talked to Adam Johnson about this
mm-hmm.
On his What do you call that place up in Missouri? With
Marley
the,
Woods.
Yeah, Marley Woods.
Yes.
How could I forget that?
Yes.
Is that what you're talking about, something that may be robotic or something? We don't know what that is.
Yeah, obviously they have to be remotely controlled, unless you have some really little guys.
Yeah, they're really tiny.
Really. But because
reminds me of that old Twilight Zone with the,
yes, yes. Yeah, boy, what classics those things were. But when you have an object that's the size of a baseball or a softball, and they are moving around on their own without wings or engines or sound, and yet they also emit an electromagnetic field that will interfere with things in the immediate area. And they'll be seen, for example, a very good example from Marley Woods. One evening, two attorneys, a man and his wife, who were total skeptics, and they'd heard about some lights being seen, so they thought, well, it'd be fun. And they're standing outside their car, 10 feet apart, and in the distance, about 1,000 feet, in a tree line, they suddenly see clusters of these small white lights moving around. And they're going from the ground to the tops of trees and in between. And suddenly, two of the objects emerge from the cluster, and they're headed directly toward the two people. And at a distance of about 150 feet, one of the objects makes a right-angle turn, flies across the field, disappears in some dense woods. The second object continues straight at these two and passes by at shoulder height between two people 10 feet apart. That's close. That's very close.
Yeah, and I think Adam told me it didn't make any noise or anything.
No noise, no air disturbance, no sensation of heating or cooling, no electrical shock. They turn, they see it fly out across the gravel road over a field, makes a right-angle turn into dense woods, and it's gone.
So some sort of surveillance, maybe.
That seems to be the logical assumption. It really does, yes. But we're having a lot of cases like that. I mean, incredibly close. So our goal is to insert the team into the middle of this sort of stuff while it's going on and get imaging from several units, and also gather instrument data on this stuff so we can begin to understand what's going on.
So in other words, this investigative unit that you're talking about that you put together, what is it, five at this point?
Five, yes.
Yeah. You use some high-tech examining stuff, taking measurements, things like that.
Yes.
And, it's kind of like a Ghostbusters, only it's a little...
it's a UFO Busters.
Yeah, right, right.
Yeah. Actually, yes, that's exactly right. And, you know, for 40 years, I would find myself going in behind an event, and you're kind of picking up breadcrumbs. And I always consider the physical traces generated by these objects as footprint or fingerprints or footprints. And they are similar with similar objects. And so what we're trying to do instead of going in behind is to be there when it happens. And we have three sites now that are tremendously active. And the owners of these areas
are all these
call
in Missouri?
Us, yes.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. And they call us even while they're observing something. And what the pattern indicates over the past 10 years is that when activity begins, you'll have anywhere from 5 to 7 nights of this activity. So we have plenty of time to get there, be there, and observe it.
Now when we talk about that and these three sites, what do you think is so interesting that something would be there?
You know,
the same places over and over.
Yeah, I have looked at everything I can think of, and there's nothing remarkable or unique about these areas. And yet, what makes them tremendously unique is I could stand in my backyard for the next 100 years and not see any of this.
True.
And yet, in these specific areas, you can. Now, why? I don't know. But that's what we're trying to find out. That's one of the legs we're trying to get down. So,
you talked about footprints and fingerprints earlier. Any evidence of real ET prints on any of these landings?
Some man getting out? Yes.
Some being?
Now, I would immediately point out that these
What size shoes?
Yes. these active sites that I just talked about, they have had just about every kind of sighting that you could expect, except no humanoids, no little guys, and no abductions. But in the landing cases, 20% of the 3,389 cases involve little guys.
Really?
Yes. Yeah, which seems to be a pretty high number. And
yeah, it's 700.
Yes. Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and from many of the 92 countries. And yet they're described consistently as 3.5 feet tall, thin, spindly bodies, large heads. And by people in countries where they don't read the National Enquirer. So they're not getting the ideas
right
from somewhere else. And I have been fortunate enough to see a number of the footprints from supposedly these little guys.
Do they have shoes?
Sort of.
Okay.
Yeah, they're not. Well, they're not barefoot unless they have really odd feet.
Uh-huh.
And but the really interesting thing is I've been able to run compression tests on the footprints, indicating that whoever left them weighed about 60 pounds, which would be consistent with a 3 foot individual, if I could call them an individual.
Sure.
But anyway.
Well, I call them people. They're an entity of some sort.
Yes, they are.
They're intelligent enough to get in this machine and get here.
Exactly. Yeah, and one would suspect to build that machine.
Yes.
So,
as you mentioned, that's one of the common denominators that you figured out.
Right, yes.
I know you went up to Aztec recently, and we're going to get into that in a minute. Going to have to take a break here in a moment first, but I've got to ask you, what is this about here on the website? You got a new book or something, or is that just your PR man?
That's the PR man, our website guy.
Yeah, he says right there, and that got my attention. So I said, print that off. I'm going to ask Ted about that.
Yeah, hard evidence to Ted Phillips story.
and so
I'm not sure I've read that even.
So the Ted Phillips story has not, well, I don't know. I think it's May 22nd, Indiana Jones comes back.
Exactly. Yeah, I can't wait. I love those movies.
You're not Indiana Jones?
Well, there were times in Slovakia I sort of felt that way.
I want to get back to the footprints and the investigations of landings and up at Aztec and find out what really went on up there. I know you went to the site, right?
Yes.
This is Jerry Pippin. Ted Phillips is with us. And the name of this organization now is Security
SIU.
Yes.
Special Investigations Unit.
Special Investigating. I like that. Mm-hmm. We need to get a reality show going here.
Exactly.
Hey,
yes.
Hey, that's a good idea.
Absolutely.
Quick, Roberta, write that down.
Contact us.
I'll take 10%. Anyway, I'm Jerry Pippin. I'll be right back.
The doors are finally open at shopjerrypippin.com. Explore our new iShop. It's open and growing. You can use any major credit card or your checking account with our PayPal connection. Our first edition t-shirt selections features three different Jerry Pippin UFO files designs. In addition, we will be adding collector t-shirts from select UFO conferences, as well as several novelty items. Check us out at shopjerrypippin.com.
Ted Phillips is our guest. We're at Eureka Springs at the end of the Ozarks, the 20th anniversary of the Ozark UFO Conference. Means it started in 1988. Where were you, Ted?
1988? That's too far back. Lord only knows where I was in 88.
You've been doing this a long time, though.
Yes, I started actually investigating on my own in 1964. With the Socorro, New Mexico landing, which was a conversion for me, and beginning of the conversion for Dr. J. Allen Hynek.
Now, so you went out there, and you just went back.
Oh, yes, yeah.
And you've been there probably in between.
Yes, I have, yes.
So what do you make of all that?
Well, the Socorro, New Mexico case is in the top 10 of all these landing cases. And as a matter of fact, in the top 5. It is a tremendous example of a high-quality, high-strangeness UFO landing. And Lonnie Zamora, I don't know where you would find a better witness than this man.
If I remember correctly, he was a policeman?
Yes.
Right.
Yes, yeah. And he was a little short on information because he told it exactly as it was, and no embellishment, no generating a big wild story. And I know Alan Hynek was tremendously impressed with him. And I have several, in the Socorro files, several little personal notes handwritten by Alan, a lot of them regarding the Air Force investigation.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And we're going to put all that on the website. I'm going to put the entire Socorro file on there. It may take me the rest of my life to get it formatted and on because it's thick. And all the photos, sketches, documents, and so on. So.
What did Hynek really think of the Air Force investigation?
Well, not much.
Okay.
Not much. It was poorly done. It was poorly funded, poorly staffed, and the good stuff was going somewhere other than Project Blue Book.
So Project Blue Book, much like many of the military projects they do, I guess redirection would be the best description.
Yeah, it's a very good description, yes. Redirection, yes.
Involved with conspiracy shows for 40 years, and that's basically, that's the standard operating procedure.
Yes, it is.
Give you just a little material there to get you over there on the other. I think a lot of redirection might even happen down in Roswell itself.
Sure, yeah. I think you find it in just about any of the events where the military is involved.
Mm-hmm.
What's interesting is that through the years I found that military folks, knowing that Alan Hynek was the chief scientific advisor to the Air Force projects, knew everything. And since he and I worked so closely together, they assumed I also knew everything. And I had several lectures at a Strategic Air Command base where there were 150 Minuteman missiles ringing it. And at one of the lectures, I'm sitting at the head table with the base commander and his wife, and she leans over and she says, "Tell Ted about the case when you were flying a B-52 and you saw and photographed a UFO." And he leans over and he tells me this story, you know. And two of the crewmen had cameras, and they shot every frame that they had available of this thing, which was a metallic-appearing disc off the wingtip of the B-52. And they could see structural detail.
Mm-hmm.
And go to the Blue Book files and find that report.
You can't.
Ain't there.
and I
managed to get a number of cases that way.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, the military, there's no question, somewhere they have a lot of good information.
Tell us a little bit about the Socorro thing.
Well, the Socorro case involved, as I said, Lonnie Zamora, policeman, tremendously credible guy, and he's in daylight pursuing a speeding car, and out of the corner of his eye, he sees out the left side window a bright silvery object with a throw of bluish flame descending toward the ground. And so he breaks off the chase and turns on a very small, very rough road, dirt road, that runs out into the desert. And this thing is coming down in front of him, and he can begin to see an object. And the blue flame is underneath it. And just before he turns on this road, there is a tourist family of 5 driving a Cadillac, and they see an object approaching from the west side. And it passes so low over the automobile, it almost hits the antenna on top and flies on out. And they see the police officer coming, and they watch he and the object both heading in that direction. And so the thing lands out in the desert. He finally gets a patrol car up on top of this ridge and stops, gets out of the car, and the object is sitting down below him at a distance of about 165 feet. And since we were just there, we could get a very good impression of how much detail you could see from mm-hmm. that distance, mm-hmm. and it's a lot. Enough to determine it's not a hot air balloon or a lunar limb.
Right.
And he can see two small guys in what look like white coveralls doing something to the underneath of the object, which is shaped like a large, let's say, propane tank. And it's sitting on four legs, structured legs. And the bushes underneath it are still smoking from evidently some sort of heating. And as he's standing by the car, the two little guys disappear around back of this thing, and there's this tremendous roar, throw of flame, and it leaps about 30 feet into the ground, or into the air vertically, and becomes stationary, and the roar and the flames stop.
So they jump-started it.
Yes, they did. And I mean big time they jump-started right. this thing. 0 to 60 and like that fast.
Yeah, right.
But it maintains that hovering position just very briefly, and then silently it starts flying away and gaining a little altitude and disappears into the distance. And he had radioed the dispatch for help, and he thought at first it was an overturned automobile when he pulled up on this ridge. And then as he got out and got a better look, he realized what it was. And So a New Mexico Highway Patrolman arrived very shortly on the scene. He and Zamora went down to the site. The bushes are smoking. They've been exposed to several thousand degrees of heating. And they found the four landing pad imprints.
Mm-hmm.
And these imprints, another thing that leads to the idea that this was a constructed, technically good vehicle. Bill Powers at Northwestern University did a very intensive study of the distribution and angles of the imprint positions. And what he determined from this study was that this thing, the landing gear was such that when it touched down, based on the terrain it was landing on, it kept the object perfectly level. So this indicates a little bit of engineering.
Yes.
And so, again, we're away from ghosts and goblins and maybes and maybe not.
Mm-hmm. Now, what about Aztec? What do you think happened there?
Well, you know, I went on the Internet, and quite frankly, the information I could see on the Internet before going down there, it wasn't too interesting and not very impressive. But when we got down there, and Scott Ramsey, who has done tremendous amount of research.
Yeah, and his wife.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
He took us out. Stan Friedman and Timothy Good went out, and we had a great time hobbling around the desert. And after hearing the story, seeing the site, and learning new things, it's kind of interesting. It's kind of impressive. And I think a good probability that something, in fact, did happen.
Well, yeah, and the thing about that story that always fascinated me was the Farmington newspaper about the flyover later. They mm-hmm. They had a big story about it.
Mm-hmm.
Back there in the 50s, I'm old enough to remember some of those headlines. Mm-hmm. You know, not of that particular one, mm-hmm. but the Washington, D.C.
Oh,
flyover.
Yes, yes, yeah.
It was on the local paper in my hometown of Muskogee, mm-hmm. Oklahoma. I remember seeing
August
picture of,
the
Capitol and the...
August of 52, I think.
Yeah, I think so.
And, well, I was
July 1, August, I think you're probably right.
I was a very tiny little guy.
Well,
then,
of course, you'll never catch me, but as I said earlier.
I didn't read that headline, but I saw it later. But anyway, it is very interesting. And what I found interesting was that the object at the Aztec site presumably didn't actually crash.
Really?
But it was my understanding that the thing actually had landed there, and suffered very little, if any, damage.
What about the story about all the 10 little bodies or 11 or whatever there were?
16,
right,
I think.
Okay.
Yeah. They were all found supposedly inside the object. And there was some theory about some overheating, a flash fire inside the object. And so they were killed by suffocation or fire.
Mm-hmm.
And but it's a case that that we're kind of probing around with, and it's very interesting.
You know, you have a big background of investigating all these things. A lot of things happened in New Mexico.
Yes, yeah.
You think that was because of our military involvement there and people were investigating, or?
Well, you would think with
originally,
white sands.
Yeah, originally yeah. I thought that, you know, all these things, when I first started doing UFO shows, mm-hmm. and then I moved to Las Vegas and did a million more often, mm-hmm. I thought, well, it's in the desert. It's one of these things that they like the desert. But but since then, we do sighting shows, and they see them in Manhattan all the time,
yeah.
in Chicago, and you name
yeah.
it.
Yeah, hog farms.
Yeah, huh?
Doesn't seem to matter. Well, I do think with something like White Sands, and, of course, where were they launching, testing the German V-2s? And so these were really the first rockets. And there were many sightings over Germany when they were launching mm-hmm. V-2s. If you were interested in the advancement, we'll say, of mankind, I think you'd be kind of interested in some of that stuff.
We will be right back with Ted Phillips. We've got another 15 minutes of the show. And I want to go back to some of the things he did with the Air Force. And he just mentioned UFOs and ETs interested in technology. I want to find out about that nuclear question and whether or not they really stopped or disengaged our ICBMs or whatever. When we come back, maybe Ted knows something about that. Maybe he doesn't. This general told him a pretty good story. So
yes.
You never know.
Yes.
We'll be right back.
The Elvis Presley Story. Collector's item thought to be extinct until recently. Now, all 13 hours of this famous worldwide radio broadcast series, produced in the 70s by rock and roll legend Ron Jacobs from Watermark Productions and heard around the world and hosted by Wink Martindale, is now available on CD. Hear the complete story, from the cradle to the grave, Elvis Presley. He was truly the king of rock and roll. The Elvis Presley Story is a collector's item with all of the music and the people who made Elvis the king of rock and roll. Order now. Limited time discount price, $39.95 plus $5.95 shipping. Don't miss the Elvis Presley Story, available to you exclusively through this radio offer. Order now the Elvis Presley Story. Hurry, supply is limited.
Ted Phillips is our guest. We're here in Eureka Springs at the end of the Ozarks, and it's the Ozark UFO Conference. And Ted, we're talking about the New Mexico desert. During that time of all these things happening with UFOs, there were a lot of nuclear activity going on as well, tests and things like that out that in the desert.
Exactly.
In
yes.
Nevada, too. But New Mexico had its share of stuff going on.
Yes, it did.
Yeah. Any evidence with your experience in the Air Force and SAC and all of that, of any of these stories of disarming nuclear ICBMs? Is that, you know, of any of that a fact, or is that just things we hear?
No, it is. It is fact. I've seen documents obtained through the Freedom of Information Act, primarily by a good friend, Peter Gersten, and there were several instances where the missile sites were incapacitated, and during the overflight of objects. And I was told at another SAC base by the base commander himself of an event in which the alarm went off at one of the missile silos, and he sent out two strike teams armed, And there, sitting 80 feet from the missile silo, was a landed object. And so the strike team leader called, and at this, by this point, the base commander, it was significant enough, he was in charge of the operation. And the strike team commander asked him, what do you want us to do? And the base commander, it was really funny because, the way he said it to me, and he said, my exact words were, if anything gets out, kill it. And if nothing gets out, leave it alone. And so they sat there for about 20 minutes, and the thing finally takes off, and away it goes. And that was the end of it. And some of those events, evidently, they didn't forward any reports up the chain of command, primarily because they didn't want to be beat to death by people coming down and asking all kinds of questions.
Yeah, that is one of the unintended consequences, I imagine, of investigations, period, especially in the military.
Mm-hmm.
There's probably a lot more of that goes on than we believe.
Oh, yes.
About, oh, don't fill that thing out.
Yes.
They'll be down here tomorrow and we'll never get anything.
Exactly. Done. Exactly right. And
so this human element has
been
part of the problem, mm-hmm. I think, along with a lot of other things.
Exactly right. And what are you going to get out of passing it along? No one's seriously going to look at it.
You don't get promoted that way.
No, you definitely don't get promoted that way. And you just get into a lot of problems, time-consuming activities.
Yeah, I've noticed a lot of pilots, when they get together, all of a sudden they start sharing these stories, and mm-hmm. there's a lot of things going on.
Yes.
But you get them by themselves, so they don't think much about it.
Yeah.
You know, they don't want to mention it.
Well, and we found in the scientific community, publicly, we have no interest in that stuff. It's bunk. And yet you talk to some of these same scientists privately, and they'll pump you to death for information, and they are seriously interested.
Oh, I've found that out. We do other kinds of shows besides UFO conspiracy shows and things like that. And you run across scientists that you meet on other assignments, and off the air, they ask you about UFOs, what you really think, and
mm-hmm, of course,
it's kind of an interesting subject for everybody.
Yes, it is.
It's the reason we do these shows.
Of course, of course. Yeah, there is a tremendous amount of interest, and the thing that that kind of excites me is wherever you travel on the planet, the one term that everyone in every country understands is UFO.
Well, you got a point there.
And believe me, you will always get new reports.
You know, since we've been on the Internet, and it's been some time now, 99, and the technology's progressed all this time, our audiences, about 35% of our audiences, especially for UFO and paranormal shows, are from around the world.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
It's an amazing interest everywhere.
It is. It absolutely is. You know, it amazes me when you can travel to, let's say a country like Slovakia, and you're in a very isolated area where communications are minimal, and my Slovakian family, my friends over there, introduced me to a high school director and one of his teachers, and through their translation, they start to tell me about a daylight sighting of an object that lands on four legs. Two little guys get out, fool around underneath the object for a while, climb back in, take off, and guess what? They left traces on the ground. And it's exactly what you would get in Missouri, in New Mexico,
mm-hmm.
Alaska, you name it, South America. And yet you're getting this in the middle of nowhere, where these people couldn't have even read reports like that. And I think it's fascinating. Brazil is another area I hope to be able to get into. And I'm especially interested in the levitation cases. Bob Pratt did a lot of great investigation.
Yes, he did, the late Bob Pratt.
Yes, yes. And he, fortunately, before he passed away, he sent me copies of all of his levitation cases. And again, these are cases that repeat themselves night after night. The individual, the mother, the daughters, and the dog go out in the evening.
And
they
one
see
of
the
them
little
or
light.
All of them are lifted
all
up,
of them are lifted up,
okay,
including the dog. And, you know, if you get one of those, you can say, well, this is goofy stuff. But when you get it over and over and over from different tiny little villages where they don't even communicate between villages, and they're describing the same things, there's something there.
And there always has been a fascination with me about Brazil. There seems to be a lot of things going on.
Yes. Always. Always.
I don't really know how to explain it. The Amazon's one of the few places I've heard where UFOs actually attacking natives. Have you run across other cases where UFOs have done that?
Actually, not outside of South America and probably not outside of Brazil.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a fact.
So I don't know what to make of it.
No.
We are trying to put together a reality show here. It'd be a good way to underwrite this thing to get Ted back over to Slovakia. What do you think of that for an idea?
I think it's great.
We can take a couple of cameramen and
sure.
Get the, so, you know, somebody, some television producer out there needs to go to their respective network and get a little funding for Ted here. He's open for it.
Absolutely. We'll take it any way we can get it. Yeah. Yeah, I think it is a vastly important project. And Dr. Hynek signed on to it in 1970. And if he liked it that well, that's good enough for me.
How'd you meet him?
I had been investigating cases just privately for 4 years. And in 1968, I ran across a case in which three guys in daylight saw and photographed an object 300 feet away as it was taking off from the ground. And one of these witnesses who took the picture is now in a very high position in government. And they had...
Now that piques my interest.
Well, that could be bad news. Even, but anyway, No, this is a great guy, but...
right, I didn't want to get into that.
But,
I'm glad you said it, but I agree.
But the thing that really grabbed me was that here you had multiple witnesses, daylight, a good, clear photograph of the object, and $600 worth of damage to their campsite, tents, aluminum cots melted, and so on. And I thought, well, I don't want to just investigate this and throw it in the file cabinet. I'm going to just take a shot. And I called Northwestern University and asked to speak to Dr. Hynek. Lo and behold, he comes on the phone, and I described the case to him, and he said, what are you going to be doing next week? And I said, I guess whatever you want me to do. And he said, I'll be down. And he said, arrange a meeting with the witnesses, which we did. And he took the negatives back to Northwestern. They analyzed them. And I had turned over the cases I had investigated in the previous 4 years to him. And he read those. He called me and he said, why don't you and Ginger come up for a visit? So I went up and I spent 2 days up there with him. And he invited me to join the Invisible College. And how could you turn that down, working with people like Hynek and Powers and Valet and Saunders and, you know. So that's actually
that's
how it was.
Started,
yeah,
huh?
And we became tremendously close friends. We investigated a lot of cases together, a lot of sites, and we shared lectures. And one night I had to even give his lecture. At a planetarium because he was almost dead with a cold. And so it was great. It was great. He was a wonderful friend.
And that training has really helped you all the rest of your life.
Absolutely.
Here in this. And then we get back to your little five-man organization now.
Exactly, yes.
Seems to me you're on the right track with that. The name of that group again is?
Special Investigations Unit.
And the name of the website?
UFOphysical.com.
And you're investigating several cases right now besides we're trying to get a little fundraising to get you back to Slovakia.
Exactly right, yes.
What do you think, if you had all the money and you could spend the time over there, what do you think your hunch would be? To be a hypothesis, but what do you think you might find down there, that crescent moon thing? What do you think that is?
I honestly
just don't know.
Don't know. The only thing I know beyond any doubt is that this thing is extremely, and by that I mean hundreds of thousands of years old, that it had to have been constructed by some pretty smart folks. How it wound up inside this mountain is quite another thing, which makes it even more fascinating. But it is there. It's
yeah, the
sitting there.
The sinking thing is
yes.
kind of an interesting, as at the top of the show we talked about.
Yes.
Was it heavy and is dropping down, or was it burying it down, or was it hiding because it wouldn't go away, or was it there for... This is things that, you know, we talked about Indiana Jones. This will make four sequels, too.
Exactly. Yes, yes. Well, I think what it is, Alan Hynek best said it, he said, it's an itch that ought to be scratched. And I sincerely believe that.
And that's a good way to leave the show. Thank you. Thank you very much. I've always enjoyed seeing you here and around Ted Phillips.
Thank you.
And we will be doing another show soon from the UFO conference. Don't go away. Roberta Scott is our own location producer. Jane Swartley is our web producer. Until next time, cheers.